Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 592, titled Update on September 11th and Related Topics. This has been recorded on April 8th of the year 2007. Well, today is Sunday, Easter Sunday of 2007, and I thought, in keeping with the, not exactly the spirit of the holiday, but with the theme of the holiday, of course, Easter is the day when Christians observe what they believe to be the resurrection of Jesus following his crucifixion. I should perhaps preface what I'm about to say and do with the following. I don't subscribe to the letter of any religion. I am not into organized religion. As far as I'm concerned, God is in the realm of religion, and religion is in the realm of politics. I actually am a non-denominational believer. There's definitely more than just a bunch of, in my opinion, more than just a bunch of dumb molecules bumping into one another, but my non-denominational faith is based on my readings of theoretical physics and some of my studies of Buddhism and other things, and I definitely don't think any of the world's major religions has it absolutely right, but all of them, or just about all of them, have parts of it right, and the idea is to live a righteous life. You don't hurt people, you don't kill them, you don't steal from them, you don't lie to them. And that's pretty good prescription for living. But I don't ascribe to the beliefs of any organized religion, but I am convinced that there's something in it. I call it the force, laugh if you will. But it's the only reason I do what I do. I believe in the law of karma. And I think, frankly, that we are headed to a time of unparalleled darkness. And if you think that's conjecture, stick around, ladies and gentlemen. But, of course, today, once again, so I should perhaps stress that I don't want to offend anybody's religious beliefs, but this is a political program, and it deals with political analysis. And in that context, we're going to begin our discussion of September 11th and related topics by taking a look at the intellectual horizons of one Stephen E. Jones. Up until recently, a professor of physics at Brigham Young University, a Mormon university in Utah, Stephen Jones has emerged as the number one, quote, expert, unquote, on the, frankly, not just incorrect, but physically impossible contention that the Twin Towers and other buildings in the World Trade Center were brought down by a controlled demolition. Leaving aside the particulars of a controlled demolition, and we'll be dealing with that at a future time. And in fact, as part of the written description to this broadcast, I'm going to include a bunch of URLs in which this whole issue is discussed at length and in expert detail. By the way, many of the volunteers who helped out at the World Trade Center following September 11th were actually experts in controlled demolition, and a number of them have put together websites debunking the frankly not just wrong, not just impossible, but frankly evil contention that this was a controlled demolition. I exclude from the inclusion in the realm of evil those naïfs who have been looking at doctored websites on the internet, and people should be aware of what can be done with pictures, an awful lot, but there weren't no controlled demolition. Controlled demolition is, well, of such buildings under the circumstances would be physically impossible. As far as I know, if a controlled demolition of a building the size of the Twin Towers is impossible. And indeed, there was a demolition of a building at the World Trade Center following September 11th. That was World Trade Center 3, which had been damaged. But it was too tall for a controlled demolition, and it was a lot shorter than either of the Twin Towers. We'll go into this at some length at a future time. There will be a number of URLs where people can examine the scientific dissection of this argument, such as it is. But one of the things we should note is that Stephen E. Jones, a professor of physics up until recently at Brigham Young University, has emerged as the, quote, scientific expert, unquote, du jour, so to speak, for the controlled demolition disinformation. I would note that one of the early people hyping controlled demolition was a guy named Jim Hoffman, who's a software engineer. When people first began floating this BS to me, I said, you know what, I think you're going to find that a lot of these people are actually working for elements of the intelligence community. Jim Hoffman, as it turns out, is employed or was employed when he was hyping the controlled demolition stuff in the early part of this decade by a company that's financed by Naval Intelligence and the National Security Agency. Surprise, surprise. Stephen E. Jones is not only was an elder of the Mormon Church, he was until recently a big supporter of George Bush by his own contention. Stephen E. Jones, his only scientific credit, such as it is, was to coin the term cold fusion, which is a bloody poor scientific credit, but that was the high point of his professional career, as far as I can tell. Stephen E. Jones, again, is the, quote, scientific expert, unquote, behind the controlled demolition contention. Stephen E. Jones is writing a book. He has the outline is online, Attacking Darwin. Basically, Stephen E. Jones is a creationist and is writing a book, the outline of which I will have online as part of the description of this broadcast. Stephen E. Jones is a creationist, albeit an intellectual creationist. He's writing a book attacking Darwin. So there's your scientific expert. And among the other things that he has penned, first of all, there is an essay that I have yet to figure out. I'm going to go over it a little more carefully. It's called Was There Death Before Adam?, in which Elder Jones, as he's discussed here, and again, Stephen E. Jones is an elder of the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, in which he tackles the issue, which is very troublesome to literalists, biblical literalists, was there death before Adam? Because fossil evidence seems to suggest that there were things that lived and died, but according to the scriptures, Adam and his fall brought death into the world, which was redeemed by the sacrifice of Christ. And in the For the Record supplemental section, one of the growing and excellent parts of the Spitfire website complex, we have this essay, Was There Death Before Adam?, in which Stephen Jones seems to suggest, yes, the scriptures suggest that real death, the death of the spirit, came with Adam, but that there was physical death before then. It's sort of equivocal. But what isn't is an essay that he has called Behold My Hands. That's really the subtitle of an essay called The Golden Era of Mesoamerica. And what Stephen E. Jones, again, the quote scientific expert, unquote, writing a book attacking Darwin, maintains here is that he uses pre-Columbian South American iconography and statuary to attempt to prove that after his resurrection, Jesus did indeed visit the Native Americans, as he is said to have done in the Book of Mormon. By the way, the Book of Mormon was discovered in 1830. It supposedly was written in hieroglyphics of sorts, which Joseph Smith was able to decipher, I guess, with the aid of the angel Moroni. Now, the fact that hieroglyphics weren't deciphered till the Rosetta Stone was discovered, which it wasn't in 1830, and sure as bloody hell not by Joseph Smith, creates problems, but not apparently for Stephen Jones. And again, I don't think any literalist fundamental religion stands up too well to rigorous scientific scrutiny. But we're in the realm here of science and investigation. And what Stephen E. Jones, the, quote, scientific expert, unquote, du jour for the controlled demolition freaks, is saying here, well, in keeping with Easter Sunday, let's read a little bit of The Golden Era of Mesoamerica. And this is from August 8th of 2001. Following the visit of Christ to the Americas, as outlined in the Book of Mormon, another testament of Christ, one might anticipate that an age of peace and harmony would ensue. Consistently, we find that a golden era, unquote, is indeed prevalent in the traditions of Middle America. Quote, the Aztecs and most other Central Mexican people believed that there had once been a more glorious era when the Toltecs had reigned at Tolan or Tula, as it is also called, all across Mesoamerica, from the Chichimecs to the Maya. Noble lineages claimed descent and legitimacy from Tolan and the Toltecs. Who were the Toltecs and where exactly was Tolon? Quote, according to the Aztecs, these Toltecs were held to be the inventors of all artistry from writing to gold working to medicine, and the very word Toltec meant artist or craftsman. They lived in unparalleled majesty, reigned over by Quetzalcoatl, unquote, Miller and Taub, page 170. Compare this description with that of the Book of Mormon Golden Era. Quote, there were no contentions and disputations among them, and every man did deal justly one with another. And the Lord did prosper them exceedingly in the land, and they did multiply exceedingly fast, and became an exceedingly fair and delightsome people. They were in one the children of Christ, Quetzalcoatl, I think. Unquote. By the way, that's in parentheses from Professor, or up until recently, Professor Jones. Not even Brigham Young University could stomach Stephen E. Jones, so they sent him packing. Continuing. During the time when the recently resurrected Christ walked the Americas, it is recorded that the people traveled to the site where he was. They did, quote, labor exceedingly all that night, that they might be on the morrow in the place where Jesus should show himself, unquote. And in the photos to this essay, basically there are statues and engravings in which some of the deities of the pre-Columbian tribes were offering, and it's quite obvious from looking at these, they were offering various, whether it's a ceremonial or a sacrificial offering, but there are little bowls that are attached to either the statues or other things. Sometimes the bowls had the pegs which fit into the hands of the little statues, and then sometimes it was the statues that had the pegs, or the bowls, the statues that had the pegs, and the bowls had the holes, so to speak. Anyway, it quite Jones in the photos to this essay, which might not be available because we've just got the text, Jones basically says, see? They have holes in their hands and pegs in their hands, which means that these are, this is Jesus, visiting the Native Americans, as he was said to have done from the Book of Mormon. Well, let's just say I'm going to have to travel back in time and see that one. Again, I'm not poking fun at anybody's religious beliefs per se, but I am poking fun at all fundamentalist literalists. For those who are riding in behind the scientific expertise, such as it is, of Stephen E. Jones, well, all I can say is check yourselves, because this is a guy who's writing a book attacking Darwin. The various controlled demolition contentions vary. Stephen E. Jones has also been talking about how thermite was used to bring down the World Trade Center, and even though the metal was the wreckage of the World Trade Center was shipped to China, he got a hold of some of it, and he found traces of thermite, he says. Well, thermite, folks, first of all, it does not produce long-lasting heat, as he claims. It produces relatively short-lived high heat. Thermite is used for, hold on to your hats, controlled demolition freaks, it's used for welding. Now, imagine finding traces of thermite on steel beams that have been welded. Amazing, huh? The actual primary application now of thermite in welding is for welding rail tracks. I would note that right under the World Trade Center, what got mixed in with the wreckage was the tracks from a subway station. But again, it's pretty interesting to watch the controlled demolition train leave the station, so to speak. No engineer at that train, folks. And we've got Stephen E. Jones writing a book attacking Darwin and yet being held up as the scientific expert du jour of the controlled demolition adequates. And his notion that he found traces of thermite on a welded steel beam reminds me, and I guess I'm dating myself here, when I was young, there was a sort of hip comedy group called the Fire Sign Theater who were quite popular. And in one of their comedy albums, they had a routine in which it centered around the building of a time machine. At one point, one character who has supposedly traveled back in time comes back and he says, it works, Nancy, see, I traveled back to ancient Greece, I have proof, look at this grape. Yeah, and that's what I think about the thermite contention. But again, for those of you who want to ride on the scientific expertise of Stephen E. Jones, he's writing a book attacking Darwin, and he claims that after his resurrection, Jesus visited the Native Americans, and that's what all these statues prove. Well, again, I'm not into fundamentalist religion, but there's a bit of an Easter touch, I guess, for those of you who have been deceived by Stephen E. Jones. So if the controlled demolition train is leaving the station with you on it, be aware that it's Stephen E. Jones and not Casey Jones at the throttle. And we've got Alex Jones, another space cadet, who's also assumed a leading position in the controlled demolition advocacy, and I guess one could say that to a certain extent the so-called 911 truth movement, not that there is not a very, very large conspiratorial complex involved in September 11th, there sure as hell was, but it ain't the controlled demolition cruise missile hit the Pentagon stuff. And with Stephen E. Jones and Alex Jones driving that train, I guess we could consider the 911 truth movement to be Jonestown under the circumstances. There is, however, a very, very interesting body of very important information that's available. One of the pieces of information available concerns the money trail, the September 11th money trail. We've spoken in a number of programs, including For the Record 530 and For the Record 536, about the Liechtenstein connections and the links of the House of Liechtenstein to the Bank Al-Taqwa, the financial organ, the primary financial organ of the Muslim Brotherhood. Another related issue was researched for us by a listener. This is from the Guardian of Britain from July 17th of 2002, article by David Pallister and Owen Bocott. Banks to shut doors on Saudi royal cash. King Fahd, then King Fahd, he's dead now, is moving large sums through Liechtenstein. It reads in part, Western banks may refuse deposits from members of the Saudi royal family under guidelines drawn up to identify politically exposed, unquote, wealthy individuals whose assets could in the future be confiscated. The move comes as details emerge of how King Fahd, head of the dynasty and one of the world's richest men, has transferred large sums through anonymous trusts in Liechtenstein, where secrecy laws allow the Alpine mini-state to function as a bolt hole for rich clients. Skipping down. One of the secret Liechtenstein trusts, the Asturian Foundation, has been used by King Fahd for over 25 years to shelter his money abroad. It constitutes a legal entity that holds bank accounts of which he is the beneficiary. It also owns his worldwide property portfolio. It is not known exactly how much money the foundation holds, but among the assets registered in Britain under the foundation's name is Kensted Hall, a mock Tudor mansion in North London's Billionaires' Row, the Bishop's Avenue in Hempstead. 2 years ago, the International Financial Action Task Force blacklisted Liechtenstein for failing to combat money laundering in general. It was taken off the list in June of last year after improving its regulatory regime. Earlier this year, however, the Principality, along with six other countries, was placed on another blacklist of uncooperative tax havens by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It now faces penalties from world financial institutions if it fails to introduce further transparency and accountability into its offshore regime. Well, one of the really important aspects, again, to the September 11th investigation, and I'm talking about the real investigation, not the Stephen E. Jones, behold my hands, Darwin is no good, look, I found thermite on the steel beams, pseudo-non-investigation. With the real investigation, when one begins to investigate the money trail for September 11th and some of the corporate fronts that are connected there, one very quickly opens up onto the vista of what Lucy Commissar discusses as offshore. And indeed, the entities involved in the money trail overlap of the Republican Party in a big, big way. Indeed, Grover Norquist, arguably the most important lobbying figure in the GOP right, was the lobbyist for many of the most for many of the significant terror-connected and, in fact, terrorists themselves elements within the al-Qaeda milieu. We've spoken about this at great length, and indeed, to really get to the foundation of the September 11th conspiracy, examining the SAR network, the Muslim Brotherhood financial networks, and their links not only to the GOP, but to an international criminal milieu, is that is really where it's at with regard to September 11th. However, I suspect that one of the reasons why the so-called September 11th truth movement has grown up, basically the controlled demolition BS and the cruise missile hit the Pentagon BS, or even crazier things, there was a nuke in the Twin Towers, and of course, then it was to choose, yeah, is to hide, first of all, the profound Saudi links to September 11th, with tremendous Saudi capital participation in American corporations, with Saudi Arabia holding many of America's T-bills, with the Safari Club, basically a Saudi-financed outsourcing of American intelligence functions it developed in the 1970s, and with the most profound links between the Al-Qaeda/Hamas/Palestinian Islamic Jihad funding sources in the SAR network and the highest echelons of the Republican Party, such as Grover Norquist and Karl Rove, it became necessary to distract. And that's why we're seeing, my goodness, it was a controlled demolition, and it was a cruise missile that hit the Pentagon. Or was it a truck bomb or an A-4? Again, disinformation designed to distract away from the real culprits. As I've said before, I don't think the epicenter of September 11th was in the United States, but there sure as hell were some very, very powerful elements in the U.S. that were complicit, including elements of the Bush administration, such as people like Karl Rove, Grover Norquist, Talat Otman, and the Islamic Institute. Again, many of the broadcasts I've done about Operation Green Quest go into that. One of the useful sources, one that I have been remiss in not using in the past, but I'm limited in terms of time, effort, and so forth, and in particular money, work a six-day-a-week day job to keep my act together, and that doesn't leave a lot of time for much of anything else. But Paul Thompson, a researcher who has written a book called The Terror Timeline, has put together a website, Cooperative Research, in which he has a lot of information, very useful information, including the following excerpt. And this talks about, shortly after March 1994, the U.S. learns Bin Laden gave prominent Muslim activist money for Blind Sheikh. Now, what we're going to talk about here is Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi, who was one of the Islamic terrorists associated with the American Muslim Council, represented by Grover Norquist, who has married a Palestinian Muslim woman and who may very well have converted to Islam himself. And Grover Norquist is the numero uno Republican right-wing lobbyist, arguably the most important figure in the Republican right, along with Karl Rove. And he was the lobbyist, basically, for Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi, Sami Al-Aryan, and a lot of other people. And one of the interesting things about Al-Amoudi, he's not only a Muslim Brotherhood terrorist, but also was one of the founders of P-TECH, a high-tech company that was developed the threat assessment software architecture for the FAA, for NORAD, for the U.S. Air Force, and also, by the way, for the Department of Energy, which manages the nuclear power plants. And I suspect that the very strange and anomalous performance of air defense units on September 11th may very well have had a lot to do with, among other things, P-TECH. And notice that with all the controlled demolition, cruise missile hit the Pentagon BS, and BS it is, there's been no real discussion of P-TECH, no real discussion of the SAR network, no real discussion of the Grover Norquist, Karl Rove Islamic Institute ties to the GOP. And notice the following again from Paul Thompson's remarkable website. Abdul Muhammad Haggag, speechwriter for the Blind Sheikh, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, makes a deal and agrees to testify against Abdul Rahman in an upcoming U.S. trial. That's from the New York Times of June 26th of 1994. He soon reveals that Bin Laden has been paying for Abdul Rahman's living expenses since Abdul Rahman moved to the U.S. in 1990. This is one of the first things that causes U.S. intelligence to become interested in Bin Laden. Further, Haggag reveals that the money was funneled through Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi and his organization, the American Muslim Council. Investigators tried to prove Al-Amoudi was a terror middleman, but could not find, quote, smoking gun evidence. That allowed Al-Amoudi to become a politically connected Muslim activist and co-founder of the American Muslim Armed Forces and Veterans Affairs Council, which helps the U.S. military select Muslim chaplains. That same year, Al-Amoudi will be one of the founders of P-TECH, a U.S. computer company with suspected terrorism ties. It will later be alleged that he was able to operate with impunity for years due to his close ties to Grover Norquist, a powerful Republican lobbyist. And that, again, about Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi. One of the things that we've noted in connection with the Bank Al-Taqwa complex, and this is discussed at great length and among other programs for the record 456 and for the record 535, are the profound connections between the Al-Taqwa milieu and the milieu of latter-day Italian fascism grouped around the P2 complex and the Alleanza Nazionale of Gianfranco Fini. And for the record 535, I speculated about the P2 Alleanza Nazionale Seize Me link to the bogus intelligence that was fed to the United States and seized upon with great fervor by the Bush administration, that in fact not only was Saddam Hussein behind September 11th, but that he was working to obtain weapons of mass destruction, the whole Niger uranium yellow cake canard, and a canard it was. In For the Record 535, in the description for it, and in the broadcast itself, I reviewed some of the profound links between the Al-Taqwa milieu and the P2 Alleanza Nazionale Italian Fascist milieu, and I speculated about the possibility that a spring 2002 meeting that took place at the Mont Pelerin Resort in Switzerland might very well have had to do with the decision to feed the U.S. bogus intelligence and lead it into Iraq, something the Bush administration was only too eager to do. That meeting featured, among others, a Gianfranco Fini of the Alleanza Nazionale, the deputy prime minister of Italy at the time, Jean-Marie Le Pen, head of the French fascist Front National, Franz Schoenhuber, former SS officer and head of the Republikaner Party in Germany, and Ahmed Huber of the Bank Al-Taqwa, and an unidentified American far-right leader. And again, For the Record 535 goes into those links and my speculation about that. One of the things that we're going to note in closing concerns when Seize Me began. Seize Me, by the way, was the Italian intelligence service, very closely linked with the old P2 milieu and Italian fascism. And we're going to take a look, we're going to close this segment with an article from the Washington Post of Tuesday, April 3rd of 2007, How Bogus Letter Became a Case for War, subtitled Intelligence Failures Surrounded Inquiry on Iraq, Niger Uranium. It's by Peter Eisner of the Washington Post. And skipping down, let's take a look at when it was that the fascist/P2-connected Seize Me, the Italian intelligence service, began to feed this disinformation to the United States. Skipping down. One person who refused to meet with Burba, that's an Italian journalist, was the CIA chief of station. A few days after the September 11, 2001 attacks in the United States, Seize Me, the Italian intelligence agency, had sent along information about the alleged sale of uranium to Iraq. The station chief asked for more information and would later consider it far-fetched. Well, so it was right after September 11th that the Seize Me, the P2 and fascist-connected Italian intelligence service, began to feed this stuff to the only too willing Bush administration, which has the same kinds of connections. And again, this will be linked in the description for the Record 592, with the description for the Record 535, and for the Record 456, in which I explored these connections at greater length. Please do utilize the remarkable and growing body of information available on the Spitfire website and linked website. There's an entire mini-library of old anti-fascist books, WFMU archiving the entire For the Record series on Real Audio, a remarkable and growing FTR blog spot. So please use the web, because if you're only listening to the broadcast themselves, you're missing the bulk of the For the Record experience. This concludes For the Record 592, update on September 11th and related matters, being recorded on April 8th of 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.